Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who, at a very young age, became a rather important figure in the civil rights struggle in this country. Our guest is Melba Patillo Beals. When she was in high school in 1957, she was one of a small group of black students who integrated Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. She has told that story now in a couple of books, one that was published a few years back titled Warriors Don't Cry, which was the story of the events really right around that effort, that desegregation effort. She has carried the story forward just about to the present in a new book, which has just recently been published, titled White is a State of Mind. It's published by Putnam, and it is out now in the bookstore. And, of course, both of these books are available. So if you'd like to go back and read the earlier story, Warriors Don't Cry, that book is still available. And it tells the story of what happened to her after that first year, when she was looking forward to being a senior at high school there in Little Rock. She, as we will discuss, found out that she and another student particularly were targeted by the Klan, and so she left Arkansas to live in California, where she eventually ended up going to college at San Francisco State, becoming involved in journalism. After that, she went to Columbia University and studied journalism there. And after earning a graduate degree from Columbia, began her journalism career with public broadcasting station in San Francisco. After that, she worked as an NBC newscaster at KRON television in San Francisco, and eventually opened her own public relations firm. She's also written a best-selling book on public relations called Expose Yourself, Using the Power of Public Relations to Promote Your Business and Yourself. And her writing has appeared also in a number of other publications, including People, Essence, the San Francisco Examiner. She now still makes her home in Northern California. And she's talking with us by telephone. And as we talk about White is a State of Mind and some of her experiences before and after, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you want to match those numbers with letters on the phone, you get WILL, which may or may not make it easier to remember, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. At any point, comments, questions are welcome. All we ask is that people try to make their comments brief just so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and try to keep things moving along. But anybody is welcome to call. Well, Ms. Beals, hello.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Illinois is a very, this part of Illinois is very important to my life because you know two of the Little Rock Nine, I believe Gloria Ray Kallmark and Thelma Mothershed, went to school in, I think, Southern Illinois University. So, and when I was little, traveling to Illinois was always the big treat. So I'm pleased to talk to you this morning.
Well, we're very pleased to have you with us. Maybe you could go back and talk a little bit about some of the events that took place before those that you talk about in the new book. And I'm particularly interested in how it is that you were among this small group of students that were involved and became known as the Little Rock Nine, only nine of you. Why you?
Well, you know, I'm curious. I'm nosy. Probably that's why I won a lot of awards as a news reporter. Because one of the things about me when I was little was that I always wanted to go and see, first, what was in the white lady's bathroom. I wanted to know what was in all these corners that white people were keeping us from going into. And so therefore, you know, when my teacher raised the, you know, said, you know, will those who want to go to Central High School raise their hands, I was one of the first. Because it had become a habit in my family that my mother would drive us around Central High School on Sundays after church. That's an 8-block diameter kind of school, huge place, 7 stories high. And my mother was working in her master's at the time, so she would drive us around the University of Arkansas and around Central High School in this white neighborhood where we were forbidden to go at night. And so, of course, anything that big, I want to see what's inside. And all of my cousins who would work there as cooks and whatnot had said, well, you know, they've got great equipment and great things going on. Well, I knew in the black high school we were getting all that used furniture, and our high school was very small, you know, was in comparison, perhaps 1/8 the size. And so when the teacher, when I was in seventh grade, asked who wants to go, I raised my hand. I said, me. And so originally there were more than 117 children chosen because they had good grades and because they lived in the area. And as the whole situation progressed, those children backed out. The parents pulled them out of the loop because of threatened danger.
Well, how did your parents feel about it?
Well, you know, we were a very religious family, and my grandmother felt it a mantle. She felt that, you know, I had to go on, that if things were to get any better, that we had to do something about it. That it could no longer be that we were waiting passively. And I think, you know, one of the significant things as I'm an adult looking back, now in my 50s, one of the significant things about my participation at Central High School was that it was a different set on the playing field. I think we have to admit that Rosa Parks certainly signaled a difference in how we were going to fight for civil rights. When that man said, get up out of your seat in the bus, she said no. But when it came to Central High School, it was even a more explosive and defiant way of fighting for your civil rights because, you know, we commanded our civil rights by going into that school and by insisting that we be allowed to go in. And in order to go in, the President of the United States had to send the 101st Airborne. So for the first time in the history of this country, a president was sending troops to protect small, you know, black children going to school. So it was like a turning point in the civil rights movement, I think. And my grandmother thought and my mother thought that it had to be. Now, my father disagreed, and there was a lot of fighting and disagreement about whether I should or should not go on. But eventually, my mother looked at me and left it, you know, she said, what do you want to do? And I wanted to go because I figured that, you know, it would be going to a new school, but once we got inside, people would say, okay, well, here she is. She's kind of cute. She's got a ponytail. She's very bright. She sings. I mean, I just did not assume that their response could be as harsh.
Yeah. For people who know anything about this, I'm sure that they would think of the event having been that first day. I mean, the day when you walk through the door under the protection of troops. But for you, that this kind of experience, it continued to be a daily battle. At least that's the way it sounds. It was fought every day.
About that first day that we walked through the door with the troops, it was about the what's called in history books, Mob Monday, when we were almost hanged, when there was a mob outside. First Monday we went to school, there were no troops there. And Elizabeth Eckford, of course, those pictures of Elizabeth walking in front of that mob have gone down in history as very ugly sort of remnants of America's distaste for integration. And then later on, we go back to school after going to court. We go back to school on the 25th of September. And the first time we go was the 23rd, Monday the 23rd. But indeed, the problem was then that the governor of Arkansas pulled the troops away from the front of the school very suddenly. He had had state troopers out there keeping us out of school and soldiers. Now suddenly he pulls them away, and we go to that school, and there's a mob there, and we were almost killed. We escaped with our lives, so that's significant. But the first day we walked across that threshold with the soldiers, I just thought, you know, this is why we salute the flag. You know, we are Americans, and if these guys just go with us these first few days, it's going to be okay. But I was very wrong. Mm. The battle mounted by those who did not want us there was quite efficient and went throughout that year. And it was absolute and unequivocal hell.
What are some of the things that happened to you?
Acid sprayed in my eyes, kicked in the stomach, kicked down on the floor, people throwing lighted paper towels over the top of the bathroom stall and then holding you in there by holding the door. You know, those were the big things, the insidious things, the continuous calling of names, the continuous degradation, spitting on me. Spraying me when my mother sewed, and she would, you know, make a new dress that I would just fondle the fabric and caress the fabric and love. I love fabric. To this day, I love fabric, and to go to school and have somebody spray you with egg. And it was just the torturous day-to-day routine which never allowed me to declare self, the inhumanity of it. That takes away your personhood. If someone calls you a nigger every day, every moment of every day, they talk about how you look, the shape of your eyes, the shape of your face, what you're wearing. You know what I mean? It's like, if you allow it to, it can take something very special away from you. In my case, I was most fortunate because I had a grandmother and mother who said to me, the only thing that's true is what God knows of you. What other people think of you is really none of your business. And if you think it's so effective, have them call you rich, because then, you know, coins will jingle in your pocket. Hmm. There's no more relevance to what anybody calls you than if they called you rich. And so those kinds of lectures and that kind of support every day was what allowed me to get through. And, of course, you know, the companionship of the other children was really wonderful because we could talk to each other about this.
Yeah. It just it seems remarkable, even though that you had obviously had strong faith and you had these two particularly very strong women in your life, that someone of the age that you were at the time would manage to have the kind of strength to endure this on a daily basis. And not only that, to go all the way through this year and then be eager to go back, because you certainly did want to go back and complete your senior year that next year.
I wouldn't say eager. By this time, I was quite weary, actually.
Hmm.
And, I think we made it. It's an act of God. It isn't. It felt to me as though we were all members of a play careening down some avenue, you know, that it was a fate kind of thing. And also, it was prayer. There's no question about which, you know, that year has had an effect on my entire life. The year has had an effect on the entire lives of many of we nine. One of our numbers recently had a heart attack at a very early age. He's a gentleman who was a runner, who's rail thin, who shouldn't have. There are other repercussions in terms of one of the number spent some time in a mental institution, having had a very difficult time of it. It has had its effect on all of us. There's no question about it. That it would leave streams of acid within our rivers of life. However, we have all exemplified the fact that we could overcome it. And in my instance, I think that one of the perhaps most astounding elements in my overcoming it was indeed, you know, a belief in God, a belief that this is all going to be okay and that this is all for a purpose. There is a reason here.
Let me reintroduce you to the people who are listening. We're talking in this part of Focus 580 with Melba Patillo Beals. She, when she was a teenager in 1957, was one of nine students, black students, who fought to desegregate Central High School in Arkansas. She has written two books that tell the story of those events and what happened to her afterwards. Her first book, published a couple of years ago, Warriors Don't Cry, and then a new one that's out now just fairly recently titled White is a State of Mind. That book's published by Putnam. That certainly should be out in the bookstores, and I would think you also could still find a copy of Warriors Don't Cry.
Yeah, Warriors is still around. I'm really proud. It's been picked up as a textbook in many schools across the country, about 24 states that I know of, and it is used as a teaching aid, and there are many sort of accompanying workbooks and programs that go with it, and I'm very proud of that book. It took me a long time to write it, but indeed it tells what I feel is a fair version of my perspective of the story. There are many, many versions of the story, but I wrote the book in hopes that if adults see it, that it won't happen again.
In the new book, really takes up the story after your story after that first year, and as you are waiting to go back for your senior year.
Yeah, and I was in a terrible bind waiting. You know, by then, this whole thing had really jaded and wilted me, and I just wanted peace. You know, when you grow up in the South and you're black, I need to explain one thing. From the very first moment that I realized I wasn't a live human being, I was frightened of what white people would do to me. Will the Klan ride tonight? Will someone come once again to my church and hang someone over its rafters? Will I be walking down the street and somebody knock me down downtown? When will I be able to sit on Santa's lap? When can I try on clothes? When will my grandmother and mother stop telling me to avert the direct eye contact with whites? You know what I mean? I grew up with all these rules that I lived by in the South, and constant fear, constant trying to figure out what will they do to us next? What is it we can do to appease them so that we can keep living? and all the time hearing daily about people who'd been hanged or beaten or lost their job or treated in some awful way by somebody. And so it was, at, you know, by the time I had been to Central High School for a year, I was quite jaded. I had had, you know, 16 years of battle, and that last year being the biggest. And so I just asked my grandmother, you know, why me, God? I know I had to go back, but I really didn't want to go back. And that, and yet I knew that I had to go back were the chance given to me. And so I was awaiting fate's decision.
Yeah.
And by luck of the draw, the governor closed all the schools that year. He would rather close the schools than have integration. And so I spent that next year of my life very sadly at home watching soap operas, cleaning up. In October, my grandmother died, and she was really the mainstay of my life. My joy, my Christmas, my Easter, my Hanukkah, my everything was grandmother, you know. And because my mother was a teacher and an intellectual outside the home, my grandmother was really the mainstay. And so that year was spent alone in the closets of my mind, in the corners of my household.
Yeah.
And at the end of that year, my cousin, who'd been passing for white, and, you know, I had several relatives doing that, called up and said, you know what, the Klan has $10,000 alive, $10,000 dead, $5,000 alive on your heads, and you really ought to get out of there. And my mother then whisked me out. First of all, we called the NAACP, who said, look, we have safe houses for you. And they had told us all along that if anything happened, we will get you out of there. And that had been their guarantee. And so we called and said, look, it's time.
Yeah, that's an amazing twist in this story, that you had this cousin who was black but who was living as white, and apparently was he actually involved in the Klan himself?
Absolutely.
And he
all those Southern sheriffs rode with the Klan at night.
That was the whole trick.
If you were in a Southern town, small Southern town, and you were an official by day, but you had that white sheet at night.
Yeah. And so he found out, and he lived in another community and found out and called your family and said...
Yeah, which was scary because that meant that thousands of miles away or hundreds of miles away, the Klan was passing these sheets around and talking about this. They were passing these flyers around. We'd seen the flyers. We'd seen some flyers in Little Rock, but to have him call from afar and say, look, you know, this has become a bounty hunter kind of thing. Folks are out looking for your behind because they know now that they can make money by doing it.
And so
$10,000 in Little Rock in 1958 and 59 was a whole lot.
Was some serious money. Yeah.
That's some serious money. That's like a down payment on a house and several years' earnings, and you know. And so we had to get out of there.
So, and that is how you ended up going to live in California.
Very hurriedly.
Yeah.
With all my clothes packed and ironed. And remember, my mother was ironing and stitching for days. And I got off the plane into San Francisco Airport, and the most astounding thing happened, which was like seven or eight white people came rushing towards me, arms outstretched to give me a hug.
And then you were startled to learn later that this indeed was the NAACP.
Right,
and that
they
were all white. And you thought to yourself, what in the world is going on here?
Well, I knew, you know, my mother had always lectured me about Jews and about the Jewish input. And I knew that Jews had started the NAACP originally and had funded some of its activity and that kind of thing. But and I met a couple of people on the board who were white. But to rush toward me in a group and extend your arm and tell me that you're a member of the NAACP in Santa Rosa was a whole new thing. I mean, it's like, how, where, how come? It just wasn't, I wasn't up for that.
Yeah.
And I was to learn that these people were quite sincere, and they really were. And I just saw these folks like a few months back, and they really were. They were serious.
And it seemed...
I'm 57, and so they have been doing this 40 and 50 years.
Yeah. It certainly seemed to be a little bit of a shock to you, and no doubt because of the experiences you had at high school. Then when you eventually met a number of people, most of them were very friendly. You went to the high school, and it seemed that with every step you were on guard expecting something was going to happen, and that nothing did.
Well, you know, the first thing that happened was that no one said to me that the people I was going to live with were going to be white.
Mm.
No one told me this. And it was by, it's kind of a fluke, that I ended up with the McCabes, Dr. and Mrs. George McCabe, who would become my parents. And I need to just say that they are still my parents today. I just on Saturday celebrated with Mom her 80th birthday. You're going to probably hear a little bit of noise in the background. But at any rate, because I'm near a place where a truck is coming. But anyway, I just celebrated my mom's, adopted mom's, 80th birthday with her Saturday. So that this white family that would come into my life when I was 17 years of age has always been with me.
Hmm.
They've been with me all my life. And they became a part of my life. And they are why, you know, partially I'm who I am today, no question about it. That dad took me to college the first day I ever went, et cetera. But when I first met them, how could I know that? They just look like white folks to me. They look like, what's the difference? You know, they look like the same white people who had been in the mob. Daddy had red hair and blue eyes, and he was more than 6 feet tall, like 6 feet three. You know, it was like time to run. Fortunately, Mom's very petite. She's probably 5'1", with little brown bangs across her forehead and little glasses. And she's the first one who greeted me and again, reached out to hug me. And these guys are Quakers out of Canada, and they lived an exemplary life in terms of their civil rights fighting and movement. But I couldn't know that when I was first introduced to them, and it frightened me to death, you know, because I thought, wow, what do you mean, come home with you? And that's exactly what I did. I went home with them, and they put me up in the bedroom with their daughters, and I started life.
Hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that in Decatur, line number one. Hello.
Hi. First of all, I guess I ought to say I'm a white male, 42 years old. I hope that doesn't have any relevance on this conversation. But I just wanted to tell you that you've always been a hero of mine. And I want to thank you for your intestinal fortitude.
Well, thank you for being a 42-year-old white male. Well, that's what my book writes a state of mind about. It's about how we all have to see and be equal. And so I see you, and I embrace you, and I, you know, God bless you. The man who is most important in my life, my dad, George McCabe, was a white male. He just died a couple years ago. And so that's cool. And I appreciate you calling and expressing that.
Well, I was raised, my parents were both teachers, and it was an open family between colors. And they were pretty courageous at that time. Unfortunately, I have to say that, you know. It's sad to say that, but why is there a difference there shouldn't be, and thanks for being there.
I appreciate you. Thank you, and your parents. You know, it was brave. Let's just say they were heroes and heroines. Let's not let go of that, because white people who could stand up at that time and allow black people in their homes or talk to them or even say hello on the street, they were heroes and heroines.
Well, my brothers and sisters got spat upon.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody at Central High School, when we were there, who even offered us a book or smiled at us or waved at us. I know a woman whose name is Robin, who lives in Little Rock today. That woman was beat up when she was a little girl because she spoke to us and smiled at us and offered to.
Is that right?
Absolutely. And, you know, she's my colleague today, but look, you know, she's a heroine. And your folks and your sisters and brothers, just for having a mind that's open enough to receive some alternative thought to what seems to be traditional mainstream. So I appreciate that, and I celebrate you folks.
Well, you're a hero to a lot of people.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call. Let me then reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Melba Patillo Beals. She, in 1957, was one of a group of young black kids who integrated the high school there in Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas. She has told the story of those experiences in a couple of books. Warriors Don't Cry was the first one, and then the new one, which is out now, that carries on the story from that point just about to this, is titled White is a State of Mind, and it's published by Putnam. Both books are around if you want to read them. Certainly the new one is in the bookstore now. And if you'd like to talk with her, questions are welcome, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. It seems that these two books are different in the respect that maybe from an outside perspective, one would say that the first one is indeed about this world-shaking sort of historic event, and the second one is a more personal story because it's really about more about the rest of your life.
That's
and
right.
I'm sure to you that's important. I don't mean to denigrate it, but I'm sort of interested in how you see these books as being different and who particularly who you think these books are for, like, particularly the new one, who you thought that maybe you were writing that for.
I wrote the new book to everybody to say, look, first of all, I've gotten so many calls from people who say, this is my story, white or black, you know, what we have to do in life. You know how a dog comes into a room and scratches till it gets a comfortable place to sit down and lie down? That's essentially what every human being must do in life, scratch about humanity until you find that place of comfort for yourself. And so Why It's a State of Mind is about my looking for my own selfness and my personhood and my home. And everybody does that. And I wrote it to show people that, you know, what you think is the answer, what you think of the surprises, what you think of the negatives are really the positives. I mean, who would believe or think that in my own life it would be white people who would walk me over the bridge to adulthood and give me the elixir and the nurturance that I needed to move ahead in my life? I would never have thought that that would have been a solution. And so I hope that my book is directed toward universal humanity, just to say, look, can we be equal? Can we see the value in every human being? And that every story really does have a happy ending. I was on the another show last night, and people called in, and everybody said, you know, for me, I really needed White's A State of Mind, because I needed to know what happened to you. I needed to know that there was an ending, a happy ending. And in some ways, the McCabes made up for all the ugliness that you suffered in Little Rock. And for me, this is kind of a universal or a God answer. In other words, God showed me something very wonderful, which is the color of evil is neither white nor black, is it? And so in some ways, White is a State of Mind is closure. It's a happy ending to this story wherein this child is abused, but in the end is also healed by the same people, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people are saying how wonderful that you've been in this family all this time and that this has worked out. You've shown us what life and love are all about. And so the response to White's State of Mind has been incredible. And what's very interesting is how many men have called up and, you know, how many interviews I've done with men who said, oh, and I loved the love story part of this. Or, you know, a guy flew out from PBS Philadelphia the other day and interviewed me. And I was amazed at how much he was just into the romance of the book. And I think it's a little bit lighter reading than Warriors was. Again, it's a more happier book about a happy ending. And about how things work out and about how the things that you think are puzzles are really just pieces to joy to come.
We have somebody here calling locally from Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. It is wonderful to hear you're talking about your books, and thank you very much. And I wanted to make a comment also about you're emphasizing that the way you felt that, you know, you're an American too, and why is this, you know, when you were growing up, why were people acting like this to you? Because you're an American too. And I notice also, and I think in our culture, I'm a white, I guess, middle class person, and I think our culture trains us to feel somewhat threatened by, you know, people of color, people with different background and different cultural style. And I notice when I'm out and around that I feel that way sometimes. And I think it's really important to stop and think that when we're feeling like that, that this is those people's country too, that their culture has a place here, and we have to stop seeing them as foreigners just because they're not just like us, and stop feeling threatened by the differences. They are Americans too, and it's just as much their country as it is ours. And I'm on a cell phone, so I'm going to hang up. But I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And you know, it's certainly important. You know, I tell this funny story about this guy who comes to the store one day, and he's making a delivery. He's got, like, you know, patches of imprints all up and down his arms. He's got on earrings through his nose. He's white, and he's got his hair sort of orange at the top, but it's black, and then dyed black, and the roots are blonde. And then he's got on this odd leather outfit, and it just, to me, I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be raped and pillaged right this minute, right? And so he gives me my package, and he says, can I come in and use the phone? And I'm thinking, I can't. You know, but then another voice says, excuse me, you never know what cloak the Christ weareth. Have faith. So I said, sure, come in, welcome. Can I get you a glass of water? So this guy walks past my cocktail table, and he looks on there, and he sees several books that I read for spiritual food. And he picks up one of them, and he looks at it, A Road Not Taken, etc., and he says, you know, if we didn't have the Lord, what would we do? And I was amazed. I was startled. Because here I was about to think things about this man that I didn't need to think. So, you know, we all have to work every day on that.
Other questions, welcome, 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-WILL. It seems somehow remarkable, I guess, one of the strange ways that things work out, that you would go from having grown up in the atmosphere you did, where you pretty much had to see white people as being the enemy, or at least knowing that, that they were not your friend, to going to the point where you would have your adoptive family would be white people, to the point then when you went to college that you met and fell in love with and married a white man. It just seems, what a strange change of direction in your life.
Well, my mom said, when I called her to say I'm getting married to this guy, my mom said, you're having a nervous breakdown. That's just, you know, you've lost it. It was terrible for me when I first met Matt, falling in love, because I thought, I am really nuts, you know. And but if you look back on it now, since I've had therapy about it, talked about it, if you look back, it becomes a logical sequence. If you see that how adorable my adopted dad was. He was really important in my life, in that I really didn't have a great relationship with my own blood father. So along comes Dr. George McCabe, who's a wonderful, whimsical, joke-telling, fabulous dad. I mean, he was a good dad to me until 2 years ago. I'm now 57. And until 2 years ago, he was daddy. And he's a co-founder of the Sonoma State University here. When I was a little girl, he was drawing pictures of a university on a piece of paper. He's going to start one, and he's driving me around to look at it. And so he was this grand image in my life. So it's not unreasonable if you look at it from that perspective, but I didn't know that at the time. I just thought I was really nuts, you know. And yet I was drawn to Matt because, number one, he represented safety for me, but number two, he was so caring and so consummate in his care of me. And I guess the most important thing was that for a long time, no one had listened to me. It had been very hectic to be one of the Little Rock Nine. Whoever sat down and listened to me? Everybody was busy training me. You know, this is how you do this nonviolently. This is how you shoot a gun. This is how you, conduct a news conference. This is how you travel. This is how you speak on stage. This is how you don't hit back. But not that many people listened to us, you know. And we couldn't talk to our parents, really, about what happened because it was just too painful and it would hurt them too much. And so Matt became, for me, a listener, a very loving listener, and certainly someone whom, to this day, you know, I respect, and someone who represented certainly the most valued thing. He was a continuation of this respite that I needed to restart my engine to live a life. You know, the McCabe started to put fuel back into me to make me feel safe, to give me some creative energy, and Matt was just the one that carried that on.
And did race never really become an issue, or was it never an issue in your relationship?
Race, never an issue between us. It was really interesting. You know, he would, at the time, introduce me. He would tell all his friends in the Army, isn't it? I said, so I got the cutest little chocolate wife you've ever seen. And he'd say, baby, come here. Come on. You know, this, and look what I found. And he was from a town in Washington where there had been no black people. He was absolutely intrigued with me. At this point in life, he'd probably called us stalker when we were recording. You know, he just wouldn't let go. But he was a very loving man. He comes from a very loving family. And, I think probably in the beginning, I yearned for and really lavished myself in his protection. He would order for me at restaurants. He would sometimes buy my clothes. He would pick out the apartments, move us. I remember one day going to work, living at one address, and when I came home, Everything in that apartment had been moved, including my garbage. The only thing that was left behind was a plugged-in telephone. And I was sitting on the floor crying, thinking some robber, or maybe the Klan or whatever, has come along and taken away my baby and my husband. And then the phone rang, and he said, "Ha, ha, ha, you don't know where you live, do you? Well, dear, here are the instructions. I've moved us." And he had chosen an apartment, gotten his army buddies, and moved everything, including the garbage.
And you were steamed because he had scared you.
He'd frightened me to death, but also he'd taken away my personal power. I would like to have had some say-so in choosing that apartment. Hmm. And that was kind of like a beginning of my feeling a little anxious here about the fact that somebody's making all my decisions for me. It feels real good at first to be cuddled, and you know, he'd do all the grocery shopping, bring it home, and it felt really good to be wifey at first. Okay? Hmm. No question about it. I loved it. Needed it. My spirit needed it. I would not probably be, you know, as writing and happy today without that period with Matt. But then there came a point when I didn't want to be just wifey. I wanted to march in the civil rights movement again. Heck, the 60s. We're in the middle of the 60s, and I'm in San Francisco. Things were humming, baby. And here I was, forbidden in a way. You know, do the dishes, do dinner, let's watch a little TV. And my mother, on the other hand, was calling me saying, "Listen, lady, black folks in this country got to get their education. You don't have your master's. You got to finish college." I mean, so I had all these voices. I could hear the voice of Martin Luther King. I could hear all the voices of these black heroes and heroines marching out there, and I was home in bed. And so eventually it really got to me, Matt's refusal to let me be personally free. But it was never, our disagreements were never about race, much more about gender.
This, and as you say, you were living in Haight-Ashbury, and this was the 60s, and of course also the time of the growing of black consciousness. Were there black people who gave you a hard time about being in an interracial relationship?
No, you see, I was in San Francisco, and that was going on all over the place, and my black relatives did, but I never took him home. I just got flack over the phone. His parents didn't like it at all, and they were annoyed. His daddy was quite more soothing than his mother. I remember one time I was visiting up there, and there were no black people where they lived. And his daddy and mother had been kind of cold, although they knew to get him home that they had to accept me. And at one point, his father walked down this hallway, and I was holding my daughter, Kelly, and he walked in, and he picked up the baby's hands, and he looked at him. He said, "Those are my hands, and that's my forehead." And true, she has to this day her grandfather's forehead and her grandfather's hands. And he changed from that moment on. He picked the baby up, he cuddled that baby, and he said, "You're my family," and, you know, he changed. Mom never really did, as I know. But it was, you know, we didn't get a lot of flack here because whenever anybody crossed Matt, he was a black belt in karate. He'd merely look at them and say, "I wouldn't do that if I were you." Hmm. He was very quiet and very imposing. I liked that about him. I felt, perhaps, sad to say, safest in my life with him ever. And you know, perhaps when I wrote this book, I could see probably why I'm not married again, because you know, I cried for about 13 days when I was writing this book, realizing how much I did love him and how safe he made me feel. And I miss that manliness now. Maybe I'd be more open to it. I still wouldn't want anybody to make me feel that claustrophobic, though, to take away, to smother me, let's say. But I certainly I loved his machoism. I loved his, you know, he's in charge, he's the man, he's going to take care.
We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes, and I have a caller here. I've been making them wait, so I won't do that any longer. Let me just say quickly that our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Melba Patillo Beals. In 1957, she was one of nine students who integrated Little Rock Central High School and told that story in her book Warriors Don't Cry, and takes the story forward in her most recent book White as a State of Mind. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Here's caller in Lawrence County. Next up, line number four. Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to tell Melba I was really glad to hear her today because her story appeared on an educational website that our school subscribes to. It's called Scholastic Network, and it was really good for the kids to read the stories of the Little Rock Nine, and I think it really kind of personalized those events for them. But I just wanted to let her know that I was glad to hear her today, and I hope to get her book.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I love the Scholastic Network thing.
Yeah.
At one point, I got like 1,100 hits from students.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a great site, but it was really good. The kids got a lot out of it.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
If only they learn to love or appreciate the person sitting next to them,
uh-huh,
who may cook different or think different or worship a different God, if only they just learn to appreciate differences, I'm pleased.
Thank you again.
All right.
Thank you.
And to another caller here, Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I am a sixth grade teacher, and I just wanted to tell Ms. Beal that I used her book, Warriors Don't Cry, and read it aloud to the kids this year, and they really were impressed.
Oh, thank you.
One quick comment I want to make is that your presentation of the power of nonviolence really struck a chord with those kids. And the book was perfect for stopping and talking about what would you do and coming up with creative solutions. And one thing that you mentioned in the book is that when white kids would insult you or threaten you, you would smile and say thank you. And
that took a lot of work.
Right.
I did, yeah.
And I noticed my students doing that to each other when tempers would flare once in a while. And I just thought that was really neat.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
One question.
You feel good.
Just wanted to ask if you were going to tour anywhere near the Midwest to support this new book.
Yeah, probably so. You know, I get invitations. I speak. Part of where in my living, I speak across the country. And so I hope to come to the Midwest to do university or tour. I know I will be going to New York. I have to confess, you guys, I don't travel as much as I used to because when I was 52, I adopted little twin boys, age 4 at the time. They're now 8, and they're little identical twins, and these guys require a lot of upkeep. Let me just say this about that. And so I don't travel as much as I used to, but I do look forward to coming to the Midwest. And,
I hope you do, and I just want to thank you for Warriors Don't Cry and recommend it as a good read aloud for teachers out there.
Thank you. I get letters from teachers and students, and I appreciate your saying that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I wanted to ask you about the experience you had a couple of years ago when you and the other your other fellow students went back to Little Rock. It was the 40-year anniversary, and the president was there.
You know, that is indescribable. First of all, totaling 100 people, we could bring members of our family, and American Airlines wonderfully flew us down there. And God bless whoever decided that was a good thing to do, because we couldn't have afforded it, all of us, if they had not. But what that meant was, ensconced in this hotel and nearby were 100 members of our family, plus the president, plus his whole entourage. And I just have to tell you that we had a ball. It was like a godsend kind of thing, you know. It was a payback for everything that we had suffered in pain. It was a wonderful, wonderful occasion. Everything about it wasn't perfect. We're not totally happy with the way Central High School looks today, with the way some of the black students are treated today. It's a four-lane kind of college, I guess, or high school, and some kids are still sequestered in a lane that does not allow them to have exposure to everything. And we're not happy with the progress, but we were happy that Little Rock had come to a place of celebration. And for the President of the United States to take time out, and Mrs. Clinton to take time out of their busy schedules to come and honor us. I mean, what can we say about that? You know, it was absolutely wonderful. And we had a delightful time there. And it was something that I will remember forever.
Going back and reading some stories about this, though, I gather there was some controversy about it. One thing that really, and here I have a story here from the Washington Post, that just jumps right out at you, is the fact that apparently the executive committee of the Little Rock branch of the NAACP voted not to support this event.
They didn't. And, you know, that was painful to us. But they did give us a little event, a reception of some sort. But, you know, that was painful to us because they didn't think that there was enough progress made. and they didn't think that it was time to celebrate because they see how folks in Little Rock, black folks in particular, have still been left out. And I just said that prior, too. There's no question about the fact that it has not come full stern. In other words, there's still more to be done. And so they were objecting to that, and we violently object to it. Right now, Terry Roberts, Dr. Terry Roberts, one of the nine, is a consultant to the Little Rock school system to try and bring things up to par, to try and look at some of those poor black folks down there, poor meaning economically challenged, who are being left out of the loop. And so, no, they weren't happy. We weren't 100% happy. But, you know, the way we nine have survived, and the way I've been taught to live, is the glass is half full. Let's look at the pleasantries, and let's look at what we've achieved, because if we celebrate what we've achieved, then we're likely to do the same thing again and do more. And so I think we can't go past celebrating our achievement. To say we've come a long, long way in Little Rock is an understatement. Mm-hmm. And so it was, for me, an inspiration, just like, you know, recently everybody said, so you've received the Congressional Gold Medal. Yes, that's an inspiration for me to do more. It's not putting a cap on everything. I'm still breathing. As long as I'm still breathing, I'm still working, I'm adopting kids, I'm trying to make the world a better place. That's sort of what I think I'm here for.
Well, there's a good part, place for us to stop it, which we'll have to do anyway. The stories are available, the two books, I want to mention them again, Warriors Don't Cry, which is now in paper, and also the new one, White is a State of Mind, a memoir which is published by Putnam, by our guest, Melba Patillo-Beals. Thanks very much for talking with us.
I thank you. God bless. And I hope everybody can see equal and be equal.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the massage therapy professionals at Bodywork Associates of Champaign. Bodywork Associates has been providing practical relief for tired, aching muscles since 1982. I also want to mention before we go here that as of yesterday, we were about $74,000 short of the funds that we need to purchase and produce and broadcast all of the shows that you expect to hear on WILL Radio during the next fiscal year. Thanks to the generosity of the Friends of WILL, we have raised more than $525,000. We're on our way to meeting our June 30th fundraising goal for this fiscal year, but we need your help to finish the job. We would appreciate it if you could mail a contribution to the Friends of WILL Radio, Post Office Box 3429, Champaign, Illinois, the zip code 61826-3429. Please make the check payable to Friends of WILL Radio. And we thank you very much. We want you to stay with us because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Much more throughout the rest of the afternoon. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.